From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Maryland's public university system will soon get a new chancellor. We spoke with the outgoing chancellor, Britt Kerwin, about changes in higher ed and how a family's income affects academic success.
Without greater success in serving more low-income students in this day and age, we're going to lose our national ethos of being the upwardly mobile society, the land of opportunity.
Then Tom Hall asks local author Jim Magruder about Let Me See It, his collection of short stories about two cousins growing into their identities. Plus, in a Baltimore emergency room, anthropologist Samina Mulla found that the duties of forensic nurse examiners to gather evidence often undermine how they care for victims of sexual assault. We ask her about her book, The Violence of Care. First News.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
Happy New Year. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. One spot to watch for change in the new year is the University System of Maryland, the network of a dozen public universities. It's preparing to welcome back Robert Corrett, former president of Towson University, to become chancellor, leader of the entire system. Since 2011, Corrett has been president of the University of Massachusetts. Corrett will replace William Britt Kerwin as chancellor. Like Corrett, Kerwin proved himself as president of one of the system institutions. For Kerwin, it was the University of Maryland College Park, then went to another state, Ohio in Kerwin's case, before being invited back to Maryland as chancellor 12 years ago. Kerwin announced his intention to retire last May and is likely to stay in the job during most of the spring semester. As chancellor, he led a redesign of science, technology, engineering, and math curricula and pushed to expand online education and to make a bigger portion of financial aid based on a student's need. When Kerwin joined me in the studio last May, I asked him to describe the biggest change since he took the reins as chancellor in 2002.
I think the two characteristics of the system today that I feel very proud about is the commitment to excellence. I think we've seen institutions across the system rise in national prominence and noted for the excellence of their programmatic offerings. But coupled with that is a much greater focus on equity and opportunity. We've seen a huge increase in the number of underrepresented minorities at our institution. We've got a major focus on serving more low-income students. We have an important initiative we call Closing the Achievement Gap to ensure that low-income students and underrepresented minorities graduate at the same rate as the traditional student population. So what I feel I think best about in terms of my tenure there is how we have worked together as a system to achieve greater excellence and greater equity.
Let me pick up on graduation rates. Only about 38% of students who enroll at Maryland's public universities graduate in 4 years. Among African-American students, the four-year graduation rate is 18% system-wide. Why are those rates so low, and what should be done to make them higher?
Well, I think the, for whatever reason, the federal government doesn't look at four-year graduation rates. The metric in higher education has been six-year graduation rates.
Okay, but a lot of us not in higher education and not shepherding children through higher education think, wait, less than two-thirds of students in this great state's public system graduate in 6 years?
It does vary greatly by institution. For example, at College Park, 70% of the students, or close to 70% of the students, graduate in 4 years. But many of our institutions are serving low-income students who have come from high schools where they may not have gotten the preparation they need. to do college-level work, so they have to start with developmental work, as we call it. Many kids are working part-time. They drop out, come back to school. So, you know, in this day and age, I'm not sure the traditional four-year metric for graduation that most people of my generation are used to and experienced when they went to college is relevant this year, because, you know, we've broadened the net. More and more young people coming to college, and as I say, many with from low-income circumstances, many not quite ready to do college-level work. So we do look at the six-year graduation rate. I will say one thing that I think is very significant. Over the last 6 years, we've gone from the average time to a degree in the system being almost 5 years. Now I'm talking about the average time,
uh-huh,
to 4.3 years. So half the average time it takes a student to get out of one of our institutions now is 4.3 years.
You mentioned broadening the net.
Right.
Has the net been broadened too much? Are we encouraging kids to start higher education who predictably won't end up with a degree and who perhaps could put that effort into something that would be more practical for them?
The way education has evolved in America, I don't think we're broadening the net too far. I mean, there are countries that have alternative tracks for high school graduates where they go into some sort of traineeship program. By and large, we haven't done that in America. And like it or not, a college degree, a four-year degree, has become the ticket to a good job and a high quality of life. And I think what we need to do in America is ensure more and more low-income students have a chance to come to college, get the kind of support they need to be successful in college. Because, you know, quite frankly, without greater success in serving more low-income students in this day and age, we're going to lose our national ethos of being the upwardly mobile society, the land of opportunity. I'll tell you a statistic that I think is very alarming long term for America. If you're in the lowest quartile of income, a child born into the lowest quartile of income, you have about an 8% chance of ever getting a college degree. If you're in the upper quartile of income, you have an 85% chance of getting a college degree. Now, how is someone in this day and age going to have a chance to move up the economic ladder
without
a college degree? So, absolutely, we need to keep the doors open widely. Now, it doesn't mean there'll be different schools that will serve different the needs of different students. College Park, UMBC will tend to have highly selective admissions, but we have plenty of institutions that are open admissions. And we just need to ensure that we have the support available so that these young people have a chance at the American dream.
Well, of course, part of what makes it possible for some students in this day and age is financial aid and borrowing.
Right.
The Institute for College Access and Success, a nonprofit that looks at access to higher education, says almost 3 out of 5 new Maryland graduates have student loans. And of those carrying debt, the average student loan debt is more than $25,000.
Right.
Nationally, the average is about $29,000. What have you done to hold down the cost of college?
Well, I think this is an area where Maryland really shines. I mean, I think there are a lot of areas where Maryland really shines. But, you know, we have worked so effectively with state government, with Governor O'Malley, with the General Assembly, to ensure that there was adequate state support to enable us to hold down the growth in tuition. We are running at complete odds with the rest of the country where, you know, tuitions have gone up in double-digit rates for many years. Since 2008, the cumulative increase in in-state tuition and across the system is about 10%. that's in over a period of 4 or 5 years, has gone up cumulatively about 10%.
How does that compare to the rest of the country?
Oh, I think the average around the country is in the 30 to 40% range. Maryland has the lowest rate of increase in tuition over these years of any state in the union. We've gone from being the state with the sixth highest tuition to the 27th highest tuition during this period, thanks to the good work we've done, but thanks in large measure to the support we've gotten from Governor O'Malley and the General Assembly.
On WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. Last May, after Britt Kerwin announced he'd be retiring as chancellor of the University System of Maryland, he spoke with Maryland Morning about some of the challenges and accomplishments of higher ed in Maryland.
Let me ask you about historically black colleges
right.
and universities, of which there are three in the university system,
That's
right?
correct.
A judge ruled last fall that the University System of Maryland had duplicated programs at traditionally white institutions, which hurt enrollment at Maryland's HBCUs. Negotiations between the state and the HBCUs on how to resolve the issue are going on. I presume you're not going to tell me what's going on in the middle of the negotiations. So looking ahead, what do you think your successor should do to heal this tension between the traditionally white colleges and the HBCUs?
Well, I think we have a very good and collaborative system of higher education. Our 12 presidents, including the three HBU presidents, work marvelously well together. And the judge cited the relationship between UMES and Salisbury,
University of Maryland Eastern Shore,
and Salisbury University, two of our institutions that are maybe 10 miles apart. The collaboration between the two of them is sort of a model as to how higher education should evolve in Maryland. What I think will happen is we'll continue to see new programs develop at the HBUs, programs that hopefully can attract a more traditional students to those campuses to address the issue that the judge has rightly pointed out. It is important to note that the judge also ruled that there was no funding inequity between the HBUs and the traditional institutions, and that their missions had not been unduly compromised or constrained. The judge did point to the lack of diversity, not at the traditional universities in the system, but at the HBU. So the goal now has to be finding means by which we can ensure that greater diversity does occur at our very fine HBUs across the state, including Morgan State.
Which is not part of the system.
No.
It's graduation season right now.
Right.
What words of wisdom do you have for Maryland's newest graduates?
Well, the words of wisdom, don't ever stop learning. You know, in a different era, maybe you could get an education and that was sufficient for the rest of your life and career. But in this rapidly changing world where new technologies, new ideas are constantly coming on to the fore, what is so important is that these students have learned how to learn, and they'll keep learning the rest of their life.
William Britt Kerwin is the retiring chancellor of the University System of Maryland. Former Towson University President Robert Corrett has been tapped to succeed him. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too, and our interview last week with Corrett. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, a local writer's short stories about growing up. Stay tuned to 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Happy New Year, everybody. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Last June, Baltimore-based author James Magruder published a new collection of interrelated short stories called Let Me See It. It's about family. It's about coming of age. It's about coming out. It's about the complexities and challenges that we all face at different times in our lives. James Magruder is the former dramaturg at Center Stage. He's an award-winning translator, a playwright, and the author of a novel, Sugarless. I spoke with James Magruder about his new book last summer. So early in the book, in the second story, we're introduced to a little kid named Elliot Bidler. He's 11 years old. It's 1971. Tell us a little bit about Elliot and then what we learn about Elliot as the book proceeds.
Well, Elliot is, this is a very autobiographical collection, as was Sugarless. Elliot is, he's 11, and he wants to please, and he wants to score very, very well at whatever he does. And his parents are splitting up. And in that particular story, he's called upon to do a fifth grade social studies project. And he and a neighbor boy build a sugar cube pyramid of Tenochtitlan. And complications ensue. And that is, as he grows older, he graduates in the recession, the Reagan recession of the early 80s, as did I, which was the worst recession before this last one. And he's just completely at sea about what to do with his life. And as he goes on, he has affairs with older men that are sort of mysterious to him. And by the end, he's not doing so well. He's dying of AIDS in Paris. I've just given away. Well, I haven't given away the whole book. He doesn't die. Well, now I really have given away the book. Anyway.
And later on, just a story or two later after the first one, we are introduced to Tom Emilio. At that point, he's 18 years old. He's Elliot's cousin. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about Tom.
Tom has, unlike Elliot has, I would say, a white-collar dad. An accountant, and Tom has a butcher for a father, blue collar, and they're related. Tom's mother is the sister to Elliot's father, but they almost never see each other. Elliot's family hopscotches around the country, and Tom stays put in Kansas City. And so he has different expectations as a gay man growing up, son of working class, without one of those, what is it, the dads who can help you invest in. That was just a few years ago about, like, you know, a smart dad or a bad dad. That's mm-hmm. about investing money. Anyway, so
there are certainly plenty of both of those.
Right. So Tom follows his head more than his heart. And so as he and his cousin never really meet until they're 25, and they're both in New York for one summer, Elliot convinces Tom to come to New York. And then their differences are made plain by their responses to the AIDS crisis.
Now, you mentioned this is autobiographical. Mm-hmm. Marion Winnick, our dear mm-hmm. mutual friend who's hosting the event at the Ivy tomorrow night, says that you've basically split the autobiography of yourself through these two characters. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
I'd say it's accurate. I think reading it all together and thinking about it, I realized that Elliot is the me who should have died in Paris in 1991, because I have had the HIV virus since 1985, but I've had a clean bill of health, zero viral load since 1996. And part of me in the 80s, was, people were acting up and everyone was dying. I was in grad school in New Haven, and I have survivor's guilt because I didn't march. I didn't help 55 people die. I wasn't taking to the streets. I had the virus, but I was studying French literature and dramaturgy. And I'm just kind of guilty. I mean, I understand survivor's guilt. And so when I was given sort of the chance, or given the second lease on life around 1996, that's what actually when I downsized myself at Center Stage and Triumph of Love went to Broadway. And then I thought, well, really, if I've been given this extra time.
That's the piece that you wrote for Broadway. Mm-hmm.
What should I do with the time that's left? And I thought, well, I need to write. I need to fulfill, quote unquote, my early promise, whatever that meant.
Early, middle, late promise.
Yes. Late bloomer.
If you got some promise, grab it, whatever period it comes from. Because you do write, this period, the book covers the period from early 1970s to the beginning of the 1990s. He's right in the middle of the sort of the apex of this terrible crisis, mm-hmm. the AIDS crisis. And it strikes me that there are two things about how we thought of this crisis back then and how we are thinking about them now. Two parameters that really affect how people approach this. One is the time difference. It was very different being a young gay man in the 1970s than mm-hmm. it is being a young gay man now. And also the place difference. And you write about places that you have lived. Part of it's in Illinois. Part of it's at Cornell, where you went to. Part of it's in Paris, where you spent some time. You write about in these different places. It's a very different thing being a gay man in Greenwich Village. Village in 2014 mm-hmm. than mm-hmm. in Wheaton, Illinois in 1975.
Right. Yes.
And so were you conscious of how people were reacting to just the whole issue of the gay movement and in particular the AIDS crisis in all these different places?
I had to change some locations around to kind of make the cousins fit, but New York in 1985, which is when the cousins get together. Elliot is kind of, he's not being an ostrich about it, but Tom is very, very aware there's something out called Safe Sex and one should adhere to it. But, I don't know if you saw The Normal Heart, which has just been on HBO
right,
this
I
month.
I have not, but I hear great
I had
great
somehow
about it.
Missed it in the 80s. Again, it might have been a self-protective gesture, but there were so many men in the 80s in New York who just didn't want, no, I'll die anyway. Nobody's going to tell me how to live my life or who to have sex with or how to have sex. And I remember at the time thinking safe sex seemed like the most ridiculous thing possible. And that's the subject of my next book, which I'm going to, once I finish reading, doing this little mini tour of Let Me See It, I'm going to try to find a publisher for.
You and your partner, Steve, have just gotten back from a place that is perhaps one of the most inhospitable places for gay people on the planet. That's Uganda. We did a spotlight series, our Maryland Film Festival WYPR spotlight series, with a fellow named Roger Ross Williams, a director who made a terrific movie called God Loves Uganda.
Great film.
And it's about, in part, American evangelicals who are going there and promoting strident anti-homosexual laws in Uganda. You were actually living there. Your partner, Steve, is a neuronatal nurse practitioner. You were doing studies. He was doing studies related to work at Hopkins. And you had to get out of there quick when the recent legislation passed. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, overnight, in mid-March, we got we were an openly gay couple living in Uganda. But again, we were Muzungus, or Europeans. That's their term, like for white people. Because we were a couple, and the real risk for us was that our servants could turn us in. We had a house girl who lived with us, and we had a cook twice a week. And if they didn't report that their employers were gay, they would get 5 years in prison. I mean, we always knew that it was going to be a little tricky there, but everyone kept saying, no, the president is never going to sign it. The president will never sign it. And then suddenly overnight, he signed it.
And signed into law.
Signed it into law.
February.
Yeah. Yes, and it was no longer. They downgraded it from death to life imprisonment now to 15 years in prison for what's known as aggravated homosexuality. So
among other things, and it does, as you say, it requires citizens to inform police about mm-hmm. anyone they suspect is gay.
Yeah. And since then, in the last 10 days, while we were packing up our two overweight cats in the household, things got dicey. The hotel clerks were calling the police when two men checked into a hotel together. There was an anti-pornography provision in that bill that meant that people were pulling women whom they deemed were wearing skirts that were inappropriate clothing, pulling them off their Boda Bodas, which are motorbikes, and stripping them publicly. And then a week after we left, there was a gigantic rally held on the president's airstrip with thousands of people and thousands of children waving flags like gays should die. And it was.
But Hopkins made the decision.
Hopkins made this, at least in Steve's case, because we were a couple. Although, again, we were just so, this is the thing, is that Ugandans have no gaydar. It's the American fundamentalists who have lost all traction here. In terms of this sort of issue, they go over there and they're sort of like, as you've seen, God Loves Uganda, they're sort of nobody preachers, but they figure they can go to Africa. And so, like, the legislation, the President Museveni's legislation, actually has boilerplate from the fundamentalists' texts about, so they're just. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you made it back safe.
Yes.
I'm glad
too.
Your health is good, yeah. And I'm glad you've written this book. It's really a great read. Let Me See It. So thanks so much, Jim Magruder. Always good to see you.
Thank you, Tom.
James Magruder, his new book is called Let Me See It. It's published by Tri-Quarterly Books. We spoke here on Maryland Morning last June. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. More ahead. Stay with us.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast.
A love affair is like a short story. It has a beginning, middle, and end. But the end, instead of being decisive, it usually dissipates in a succession of messy anticlimaxes. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote that in his memoir, The Lost Summer. Now, nearly 8 decades later, romance hasn't gotten any easier, and writers continue to document the heartbreak. Journalist Adele Waldman is one of them. The Baltimore native has written a novel called The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. In it, she takes on the perspective of a young man dating in New York City. I spoke with her in July 2013 and started by asking her to describe the lead character, Nate Piven, who's a writer in his 30s living in Brooklyn.
He has recently had some professional success as a writer after years of struggling, and he is enjoying an upswing in his popularity with women, but the women he's involved with aren't always enjoying the way he treats them as much as he is enjoying his situation. He's not a bad guy, but he sometimes upsets the women he is involved with.
Yeah, and if I want to understand a character like this, and frankly, he's unlikable enough to me that I don't know that I really wanted to understand him, but why would I read your novel? Why wouldn't I read something written by a man?
Right. Well, my thinking, when I got this idea to write a novel about modern relationships from the perspective of a male character, why I did this was because I felt that I had read a number of novels written by men about young men who come to the big city and conquer it with their intellects and have these romantic adventures. And I felt that they often let their male protagonists off the hook for the way they treated women. And they do that in various ways, maybe by making the women characters very unsympathetic. So as a reader, you don't really care very much when they're not treated that well. And I thought that wasn't true to my life or the lives of women I knew. I thought I would write a similar book about a male character, but I would really scrutinize the way he treats women, the way he thinks about women, and to be fair to him, but also to not give him a pass and not glorify his behavior in any way.
Are there things that then you, as a female writer, can that you perceive and that you can say that a male writer wouldn't or couldn't?
I think there are things I can say. My character says things that are certainly sexist and in this day and age would be perceived as misogynistic about women's intelligence, about women's writing, that I don't think a male writer would feel comfortable saying because he would be afraid of being of the words being attributed to him, not just his character. And I think as a woman, I had a little more flexibility to explore some of my character's uglier thoughts. And I did that because I felt like it was important to talk about these ideas that some men, I think, may think, but they're not likely to speak of publicly.
How much of it is based on your own experience?
In some sense, 100%, but in a looser sense that I mean, it's fiction. I wanted it to be true in a general sense, true to life and true to modern relationships. In terms of whether it's literally true, it's not very much at all. I felt like the truth of the central relationship of the book is one I can relate to, the emotional truth, but the specifics, I've never dated someone exactly like Nathaniel P. And the truth is, for better or for worse, there's some of me in him. He, like me, is from Baltimore. He, like me, is the child of Romanian immigrants. And so he's a mix. I've never met him.
So what do you hope a young woman who's dating takes away from your book?
I hope that the book doesn't scare her, because there are aspects of the book that I thought were a little bit uncomfortable to write, honestly, about certain thoughts my character has that were troubling to me. I almost wished I could unthink them once I had thought them about. He's very critical of the women he dates. Once he starts to lose interest, he starts to scrutinize them. He thinks thoughts about their appearance that are very uncomfortable for me to write. And at times I cringe at the thought of young women reading a book and being a little bit frightened by that. On the other hand, what I also wanted women to take away from my book is I think many women have had the experience of dating a man who seems very enthusiastic at first and goes all out to be a perfect boyfriend. And then at a certain point, his behavior changes, he cools off without explanation. And I wanted women to know that they're not alone. This happens a lot, that that it's...
As I hear you say that right now, and it didn't cross my mind when I was reading, but it's almost like you're really sort of explaining the truth of it's not you, it's me, because he's the one
right.
that's losing interest in the relationship, independent of any, of almost anything she's doing.
Right, right. And I think that can be so perplexing when you're on the other side of it, because you think, what have I done? Why is this person changing? But I want, through the book, I think you see he's ambivalent about being in a relationship, and he changes for no particularly good reason, and it's certainly nothing that his girlfriend has done.
Well, congratulations on the book. And thanks for coming in to talk to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Baltimore native Adele Waldman. Her novel is called The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P. I spoke with her in July 2013. We've got more about the book on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Less than a third of sexual assault cases go to court. So when anthropologist Samina Mullah says that what a rape victim experiences when she reports it can be as bad as the assault itself, she's not talking about insinuations by defense lawyers at trial or even about police departments dismissing cases without really looking into them. Mullah, assistant professor of anthropology at Marquette University, is talking about the forensic examination in the emergency room that, she says, often re-victimizes an assault survivor. Professor Mullah did her research in Baltimore at the emergency room designated to handle forensic exams of sexual assault victims. The book she published about her conclusions is titled The Violence of Care, Rape Victims, Forensic Nurses, and Sexual Assault Intervention. We spoke with her by phone last summer.
The point I want to make is not that individual forensic nurses make choices that contribute to the negative experiences that victims have when they come forward, but that the institutional routines and protocols themselves can make even a very sympathetic, very sensitive nurse convey a sense of revictimization or contribute to the revictimization of a victim.
Let's back up a little bit. While you were a graduate student at Johns Hopkins, you volunteered for 4 years as a rape crisis advocate. What did that involve?
Well, that involved me getting trained to accompany victims of both sexual assault and domestic violence during their hospital stays. I really saw no way to do this research kind of by being a fly on the wall. That didn't make sense to me, and so I wanted to participate and contribute something. And so my job was to accompany victims and make sure they understood what the processes were, made sure that all of their questions were answered, and helped them communicate their needs and desires and concerns to all of the personnel that they encountered, whether that was the police or most often it was these forensic nurses.
And what is the role of the forensic nurse examiner?
Well, the forensic nurse examiner is quite a wonderful innovation in many ways. It's a relatively new profession, if we can think of something that's about 20 to 25 years established as relatively new. This would be a nurse who has all of the credentials. They're typically registered nurses who do additional training in order to gather the expertise together to collect evidence from victims of violent crime in general. Many forensic nurses will see all kinds of crime victims. But there is a specialization of SANE nursing, sexual assault nurse examiners, who really have a very deep skill set when it comes to evidence collection from rape victims. And the innovation comes about because, there's initially the model is you show up at an ER and whoever is on staff, an OBGYN resident, is reading instructions from the crime lab and conducting this examination without really having the expertise or understanding to do that. Now, the problem, as the profession has become more established, and the leadership in the profession is very well aware of this, is that sometimes collecting evidence is antithetical to the work of taking care of a patient. This person is also your patient. And so there's a tension in the examination between providing all of the nursing care, right? That's why you have a nurse conducting this evidence collection, and also collecting the evidence.
That's Samina Mulla, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Marquette University here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her research on how victims of sexual assault are treated in Baltimore and the book she wrote about it called The Violence of Care. So it seems to me that you're basically saying that forensic nurse examiners are almost in an untenable position, having both the duty to care for a patient and the duty to collect evidence for a legal procedure.
I would say that that's an accurate characterization, but I do see hope in the sense that a more mindful and also realistic understanding of what is likely to happen with the evidence one collects might potentially ease the burden that nurses feel to sometimes really push victims perhaps farther than they're comfortable going.
Well, when you say awareness of how the evidence might be used, you're referring to... Yes?
Yeah. We have this perception that sexual assault or all crimes leave these unambiguous markers on the body when human bodies are quite amazing things. And so it's very uncommon, in fact, to find injury or to find, for example, semen is something that we commonly associate with rape kits, right? We're looking for DNA. But we also have all of these lovely crime statistics that tell us, for example, that most sexual assaults occur between individuals who are known to one another. So the stranger rape model that we have of someone who doesn't know you jumping out from behind a bush or an alley, I mean, that happens. It's not that doesn't happen. But that's in the minority. Some studies say it's upwards of 60%. Some folks say 90% of what we might call the acquaintance rape. So if what you're looking for is DNA, and there's really not necessarily going to be sign of injury, the DNA is not going to really help you solve the crime if we all know who the parties are that are involved, right?
The question really is consent, not identity.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we've seen defenses change to accommodate DNA. And the new research I'm doing, we'll even see defense attorneys in stranger cases argue that, the parties were known to one another, or argue that the victim was a prostitute. We see that a lot here in Milwaukee right now. None of that surprises me. So the sort of emphasis on the DNA just shifts the defensive strategies, even where you're talking about stranger assaults. But again, those are the minor handful of assaults. Most of the time we're talking about people who know each other. They might be family members. They might be husband and wife, boyfriend and girlfriend, father and daughter, and we see that. That's very common as well. And in those cases, a sexual assault forensic examination isn't really going to help anybody solve the case.
Samina Mulla, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Marquette University, observed forensic exams of sexual assault victims in Baltimore and wrote about it in The Violence of Care, Rape Victims, Forensic Nurses, and Sexual Assault Intervention. We've got more information about the book on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and links to essays Professor Mulla has written connecting her work to Ferguson and to sexual assault on campus. More of this interview there, too.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.